As well, thank you. Here we go, just like making sure that we're recording everything here. And we're thanking our sponsors who are sponsoring both this full day itself, and of course, thanking to Serena David Kashitsky, in memory of Riva Kashitsky, Zichrona Levracha, and as well as this year, particularly to thank David and Chani Klein, who are sponsoring in memory of Zvi Hirsch Ben Peretz, Zichrona Levracha, and by Neville and Lynn Richter, in memory of their parents and grandparents, Zichrona Levracha, Neshama should have a An aliyah, and to Mar, in honor of my giving the Seder Boker Shiurim. And once again, this offers me the opportunity to invite all of our adult males who are on the Zoom here to join with us Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, 10 to 12 on our adult Seder Boker that we have doing every day. Any questions that there are, you can please pop me an email. Okay. So I took my job here very, very parameter wise. In terms of specifically, he's talking about the Cave of the Machpelah in Hebron. I'm not going to talk about Hebron as a larger city. I'm not going to be talking about Hebron as a city of David when David developed it. I'm not going to be talking about Hebron later on, but specifically about the Marat Machpelah and who actually is buried in the same Marat Machpelah. I guess to get us going there, you got a picture there by Gustav Dior, who is, of course, a 19th century artist or graphics. And who is well known for creating many of the woodcuts in many of the classics that were published in the 19th century, as well as some of the books of the Bible. And then, of course, you see his understanding of Abraham. This is Abraham. Let's see if I can get somebody to point it out there. This is Abraham, who is leaving the Marat Machpelah, taking one look back at Sarah, and who is coming, being buried here, and somehow she's being placed vertically. I don't know what they were thinking. And they're, of course, putting the stone against her to lock this up. Maybe they felt in those days that's how burial was done. Maybe they found pharaohs who were buried like this. But this was his interpretation. And nowhere is there a cave of this nature, really, in Marat Machpelah. It's complete a figment of Gustav Dior's imagination. But here's what you see. And when you come to Hebron today and you do see the Marat Machpelah, just some pictures to give you some kind of reference. This is what we normally see. You see this big building made of Haronian stone. And by the way, Herod probably built this before he got to work on the Har HaBayit. This may have been a dry run for Herod. It's about 1/7 the size of the Har HaBayit. And this is a view from the air of the same building. By the way, the center is really open. This may have been built on the foundations of a Hashmonean building that was underneath itself. And of course, many of you are used to, if you've been to Hebron and been to Marat Machpelah, you're used to going into this building. The entrance is today over around here. Once upon a time, the entrance had been there. Once upon a time, the Jews could only go up to about the seventh step here on this side where the old entrance was. Today, of course, we're allowed to wander pretty much half the building. At one point, we could wander the entire building. And what people mostly don't know is that as you walk into the building and find the different kinds of stones or tombstones that are set up, and here is President Yitzhak Herzog and Hanukkah, who is came to light Hanukkah menorah there. And here he's davening in front of, not sure which kever he is davening in front of, one of the kvarot, or one of the sepulchres that are set up. And the sepulchres really have no real relationship to where the actual tombs themselves are. And that part of what we're going to discuss about is where the tombs are, what are the tombs, and who could be buried, and actually the tombs of the patriarchs, or is anyone buried there right now? Because the tombs themselves are actually not on above the ground as you normally think they are. The tombs themselves, if you can see this pointer here on this upper left picture, if you can actually draw a line right across here going down under the ground is pretty much where the tombs are. And probably on the left side of the picture, down even further into the ground, is where possibly and probably the tombs of the patriarchs and matriarchs actually are. And that's what we want to kind of show you today, because this is an eye-opener for people who normally think when they go and do the prayers and say the Tehillim there in front of these large sepulchres, and we'll show you some of them as we go through this, they think they're actually standing at the gravesides of Avram and Sarah and Yitzchak and Rivka and Leah and Yaakov, and maybe Adam and Chava, but it's not really true. They're much below the ground. Let's kind of just take a quick look on the share screen that's up here in terms of what we know about who is buried in Marat Machpelah, then we'll take a look and see in terms of some of the others, people who might be buried there. So the references are in a few places in Sefer Bereishit, in Bereishit chapter 23. We'll do this fairly quickly because most of you know this. If not, you can go through it slowly. In chapter 23 in Bereishit, in the beginning of Parshat Chayisara, Sarah dies. It's called Chayisara, the life of Sarah, but as we know, it's really the death of Sarah. And Avram comes to buy the Marat Machpelah, or to buy the entire field. And by the way, just look very carefully here. We call it the Maris Machpelah, the Cave of the Machpelah. But look and read for me verse 17. Vayakam Ste'efron, the field of Ephron, which was in Machpelah, Sher Bamachpelah, Sher Lefnei Mamre, HaSadev, Amorah Shebo, V'cholitz Basadev, Sher Lechom V'gvaslev, was given to Avram as a possession. So what is it called? The field is not, the cave is not called Maris Machpelah. It looks like the field or the area itself is in Machpelah. This is the field of Ephron, which is in Machpelah, as if to say that I'm going to a place, I don't know, Bavel Street, which is in Vaughan. So Vaughan is not the name of a specific cave. Vaughan is simply the name of a geographic location. And we'll come to that in a moment. Bottom line is Avram buys the field, buys the cave, and he, of course, buries Sarah in that cave. And she dies at an age of 125. About 40 years later, so Avram dies at the age of 175, and this is chapter 25, only two chapters later in the Chumash. And, of course, who comes to bury him? Yitzchak and Yishmael get together, enemies one life, but when it comes to coming to the Kfura, they come together, and they come to Maris Machpelah. Here it's called once again Maris Machpelah, not the Marah that's in the Machpelah, in the field of Ephron, and they bury once again in the field that Avram has bought. And who is buried there? Avram and Sarah, his wife, is buried there. That's the first pair that we know are buried from the Torah. And then we don't really find a reference directly to the actual death and burial of Yitzchak or the death and burial of his wife, Rivka. We don't really find the burial of Leah. But at the very end of Sefer Bereishit, we read in Parshas Vayechi a few weeks ago, 2 weeks ago, a week and a half ago, we read about Yaakov is coming to the end of his life, and he requests, as he dies in Egypt, please take me back, take my body back to the Marah, to the cave that's in Sde Ephron, into the cave that was in the Sde Machpelah. Once again, Sde of the Machpelah is the cave, a double cave, is the place called Machpelah, and which was purchased by Avram from Ephron Achiti. And there we find the reference to all the people that are buried. Avram is there with Sarah, Yitzchak is there together with Rivka, and there I buried Leah, and now I will join my wife Leah there. And the field was purchased from the children of Chet. And in fact, that's exactly what happens in chapter 50, the last chapter, Sefer Bereishit. They take Father Jacob back and they bury him in Sde Machpelah. So when you read the stories here, we know about the burial of the patriarchs and matriarchs, Avram and Sarah, Yitzchak and Rivka, and Yaakov and Leah. We know about no one else as well. But we don't really understand what is the reason for why the cave is called Maris Machpelah. What does this mean? Some of you know it's going to say, well, it means double cave. It's a double cave. Well, let's see what happens here in the Babylonian Talmud. There's a machloka between Rav and Shmuel. We'll look at the English here. And they seem to agree that it is a double cave. We're not quite sure what is a double cave. Is a double cave horizontally? Is a double cave one? There are two rooms, one room and then another room inside of it. And one is going to say, no, it's a two-story cave. One cave and actually with a cave below it as well. Actually, it's possibly that it might be both. It might be horizontally, that they're going one into the other, and as well maybe going further down into the ground from what we can find out based upon our discoveries in the last 20, 30 years. So the Gemara says, well, if you say it's Machpelah, it's a double cave, I understand what this means when you have a cave inside a cave. But if you tell me it's a two-story cave, well, every house is made with two stories, and many houses are made with two stories. So the answer is, it's not just a double cave, but the people who are buried in doublets. Husband and wives are buried together. Avram is buried together with his wife, Sarah, as a zug. They're buried as a pair. And the same thing with all the others. And here the Talmud tells us about another pair. Adam and Chava, Adam and Eve are buried in Maris Machpelah. Avram and Sarah, Yitzchak, Rivka, Yaakov, and Leah are buried there. So you have four sets. It's not called Maris Machpelah because there are four sets. It's called Maris Machpelah because each of these people are buried as a set, buried as a husband and wife together, as a doublet of a male and female together. That's why it's called the Maris Machpelah. That's how the Talmud understands it. The Ramban has a discussion. He quotes Rashi, which Rashi quotes, and Rashi is quoting the Talmudic explanation of the English here, so we can follow it as well. Rashi says it's an upper and lower cave, and so forth and so on. The Ramban says that doesn't make any sense because, as I pointed out to you when we saw verse 8, verse 17, in the original purchase by Avram, it seems to say he's buying the field of Ephron, which was in Machpelah, which means Machpelah is a larger place. Machpelah is the Vaughan, and Bathurst Street is the smaller location, or maybe Bathurst and Steeles is a smaller location, and Vaughan is the much larger location. So Machpelah is not referring to the actual field. Machpelah might be referring to the location. So the Ramban says, I'll tell you what it means. It's the name of the place, but there's something else that's going on here. And here the Ramban quotes a Medrash Rabbah. And the Medrash assumes that Adam and Eve were humongous, were very large in size. Maybe they were shrunk down later on, but they still remain larger than life, both in terms of their relationship to the Almighty and as well larger in life in terms of their size. And so the Medrash says that the Holy One, blessed be He, doubled up the stature of the first man and buried him there. Why is it called Maris Machpelah? Because in order to get Adam and Eve into the cave, or specifically Adam, they needed to be doubled over to fit them in. In other words, the name of the cave or the name of the place precedes the entire burial above that's going on in of these individuals. Not that it's called Maris Machpelah in light of having these great individuals buried there, but it's called Maris Machpelah, referring to the event that goes back to the beginning of time, which is the burial of Adam, who needed, of course, to be folded up. These are the people who we know are buried in Maris Machpelah. Now, some other people who the Midrashim say are buried there, according to the Midrashim, according to the Islamic tradition, Joseph is buried there, and you will see a sepulcher for Joseph that's in Maris Machpelah. Our tradition says Joseph is, of course, buried in Shechem. According to a very famous Midrash, the head of Esav is buried next to Yaakov in the Maris Machpelah. This is, you know, the story of the selling by Esav to Jacob of the birthright. Together with the birthright came the rights to being buried in the cave of the Machpelah. That was it. They're coming to bury Jacob. They schlep him up back to Canaan, all his sons. And who shows up? Esav shows up and says, why is he going in there? That place is reserved for me. There's a big argument in the Midrash Rabbah that quotes it. In fact, they say, but you sold it. This is part of the deal that you sold to your brother when you gave up the birthright. And he says, prove it. So the Naphtali runs all the way down to Egypt. He's a quick runner, so to speak. Naphtali ayah al shulcha. In the interim, they're waiting for Naphtali to come back and bring the deed. And Hushim ben Dan is this son of Dan who is a deaf and can't really understand what's going on. He doesn't follow what's going on. He sees this person standing who was in the Zeta, can't be buried into the cave. He takes his sword out, chops it, and kills Esav, and Esav's head rolls into Yaakov's grave. And so according to the Medrash, the tradition is as well that Esav's head is buried there. That's simply Medrash. There's no other proof that's really for it. So this is really all about what we know from biblical times or Midrashic times in terms of what there is. The building that you see really is a Herodian building. They're probably, or is likely from what we can see, and I'll come to this a little bit in a few minutes about what we actually know about underneath the ground. There probably was some type of Hellenistic building that existed beforehand on top of the graves. And the Herodian structure that was built was somewhere between 31 and before the Common Era and maybe 4 before the Common Era, the very end, the right before the year zero. Herod builds this large rectangular structure over the cave to commemorate the site for subjects. It's, by the way, the only really surviving, fully surviving Herodian structure from the period of that time period. Everything else Herod didn't finish. This was actually looks like it was completed. It is open. There is no really roof on top of it. Any roofing was added later on to certain parts of it. But as it was really built simply to be simply a structure to contain within it. So this is all about what we know about the actual people who are buried there and the building as presently structured as you see it. And once again, what I want you to take away from this lecture is to understand that everything I told you is really about not exactly what you see today. What you see today is this Herodian building. And on the Herodian building, above ground, they put these large sepulchres as if to make you think that right below the sepulchre is the burial of Abraham and Sarah and Yitzchak and Rivka and Yaakov and Leah. And that's not really true. Okay, but before we come to that, just to spend a few minutes about some of the things that came up in the Middle Ages. And you know that in the Middle Ages, there was a lot of discussion in the Christian world about relics, about pieces of wood that came from the cross of Jesus and other types of stone that may would go back to the time of Jesus. And so you find there are stories that begin circulating. This is a very interesting kind of story. It finds that in the year 1113 in the Common Era, this is when the Christians are in control of Jerusalem. That's why you'd have a relic story coming up. In the reign of Baldwin II of Jerusalem, according to Ali of Herod, and a certain part of the roof over the cave of Abraham gave way, and a number of Franks made their entrance into it to see what was there. And they discovered, believe it or not, don't believe it, please, and they discovered, believe it or not, the bodies of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, their shrouds having fallen to pieces, lying propped up against the wall. Maybe this is where Gustav Bior got the idea that Sarah was standing up. They found the bodies, and the bodies were whole, and the bodies were okay, except for the shrouds were coming apart. This is once again in line with a lot of types of relic stories that we find in medieval Christianity. And then the king, this is King Baldwin II, after providing new shrouds, he was such a generous king, provides shrouds for them, caused the place to be closed over once more. So similar kind of idea you find in another chronicle from pretty much the same time. that the tomb of Abraham was opened up, and those of his two sons, Isaac and Jacob, obviously not exactly correct, the son and grandson, or maybe his two descendants. And many people saw the patriarchs, and their limbs had not in no wise been disturbed, and beside them were placed lamps of gold and silver. And I believe the understanding is that these lamps were miraculously burning all the time that were there. So in other words, we've got these kinds of stories. Where did it was? What did they see? Where was it exactly standing? Where was the cave? It's surely not where we see it above the ground. It was somewhere down below. But it's really hard to accept the story literally, that the bodies after all these years, because we're going back now to about the year, probably 1200 before the Common Era, maybe earlier, 1300 before the Common Era, when Abraham dies and the other patriarchs die, and it's a round number, that we assume that for 2,000 years these bodies had not decayed whatsoever, and they were just lying there simply because the roof caved in. Okay, but that's one story that goes back to the Middle Ages. Another story, similar story, we know that Binyamin of Tudela actually travels around many places in Eretz Yisrael. He visits the city of Hebron, which in those days was called Saint Avram de Bron, because named after Avram, right? And there's a great church there called Saint Avram, which is giving name to the city. This is actually what is probably today the Herodian structure, only they built a church within it. There was a Jewish place of worship at the time of the Mohammedan rule. In other words, we know, by the way, interestingly enough, according to Binyamin Tudela, there was a shul that was there when the Islamic ruled over it. But they may have probably taken it down when Christianity took it back. The Gentiles have erected their six tombs, respectively called those of Avram, Sarah, Isaac, Rebecca, Jacob, and Leah. Ah, the first time we're actually getting to learn that these tombs were put up, what you see today may only be from the Middle Ages, these big sepulchres that you come across. And the custodians tell the pilgrims that these are the tombs of the patriarchs. But maybe they're not. You read between the lines. They tell them these are the tombs of the patriarchs, for which information a pilgrim gives them a custodian money, while everything is for money. If a Jew comes, however, and gives a special reward, the custodian of the cave opens a gate of iron, which was constructed by our forefathers. He's able to descend below by means of steps, hold the lighted candle in his hand, and he reaches a cave. He goes down, which we don't know where this cave, by the way, is, in which there's nothing to be found, and a cave beyond, which is likewise empty. He reaches a third cave. We don't know what the third cave is really referring to, because there is no third cave down below. I'll show you in a few minutes. And there are six sepulchres, Avram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov, and they're facing Sarah, Rebecca, Rivka, and Leah, upon which the names of the three patriarchs and their wives are inscribed in Hebrew characters. And the cave is also filled with barrels containing bones of people, not the bones of the patriarchs, but people who wanted their bones put there. This was a holy place, probably for Jews, and possibly even back to First Temple times, which are taken there as a sacred place. At the end of the field of Machpelah stands Abraham's house with a spring in front of it. So some kind of structure that they felt went all the way back to Abraham. This, by the way, if you have the sheet in front of you, we're not going to read this. This is just a different translation of the story of Binyamin of Tudela. Once again, that this was apparently in those days, people would come, they would visit it, and they would go down to see some kind of underground chamber that was below the ground. And sometime below the ground, there was some kind of tombstones or sepulchres that mimicked what was above the ground, maybe smaller. Maybe we get the feeling that these were the place where actually the patriarchs and matriarchs really had been buried, but we don't know for sure. So that's what we know from the Middle Ages itself. Now, before we come to that, what we know about the modern world, there's actually one other reference, and I'm sorry, I did not put it here in the sheet. And for those who are actually following us here, let's kind of just make sure in case you didn't get it before, here's the sheet again, okay? There you can find it. So there is another reference which probably is historically correct, and that's a reference from a monk in the year 1119 before the Common Era. This is pretty much around the time of this Baldwin two-story about the cave then, and there was found the people with shrouds lying around. But there was a monk named Arnold, and after it was another monk who had been wandering around, and he felt a draft coming from somewhere there. And the other people began taking out the stones, and they found a room down below underground, which was filled with little Herodian masonry, like the Herodian stones that you see outside the building on this is below. And Arnold, this monk by the name of Arnold, once again in 1119 in the Common Era, he's still searching for the source of this draft. He hammers on the cave walls until he hears a hollow sound, pulls down the masonry in that area, and discovers a narrow passage. And this narrow passage was covered with masonry, but was partially blocked up. He unblocks parts of it, and he finds a large round room with plastered walls. And in the front of the room, he finds a slight square stone, slightly different from the others. And upon removing it, he actually finds there's a cave below it. The caves were filled with dust. And he removes the dust. He found bones that were in these caves. I want to show you exactly where we think he was in a moment. And they believe that these were, he believed these were the bones of the patriarchs. They probably, in all likelihood, were not. They were bones of what we saw before, referenced by Binyamin of Tudela, of people who had died, Israelites who had died, who had wanted their bones buried there in a sacred place. Arnold goes and washes, this monk goes and washes them in wine and stacks the bones nearby. And he carves inscriptions on the cave walls describing whose bones he believed them to be, and they're actually inscribed in Latin. Just to kind of take you back to our theme of where we think he was, because, wrong share screen. Let's go back here. So where is it? Here it is, okay? So what do we think is going on here? Let me take you down below to, before we show you these pictures, which will kind of be eye-openers to you if you've never seen them before. Just want to show you a bit of what we think the map of what's below Maris Machpelah is really all about. Okay, there are two pictures here on the last page of your handout. They're the same kind of picture, only there are two really graphics. The first graphic is a horizontal version. So if you have, I'm just going to show you here with my little pointy little circle here. Let's get that up there with my circle. Here it is. So once again, this is ground level. When you walk into the cave of the Machpelah, you are walking in here, and you're going to be on the ground level. There is over here, there's actually the sepulture of Avraham. And as you walk further, you're going to find the sepulture of Yitzchak. That's actually what's over here. And then you walk around, and there are other patriarchs that are there. So we believe that somehow this monk was able actually to get somehow underground somewhere. We don't know if he came in this way or if he came in this side, okay? But he was able actually to go down on the ground where he was able to find some of these caves, two of the caves which we know that are there today. And he was able to see that there were bones in one of these caves, probably in the second cave as well. So this is the first time that we actually have a reference to something taking place underneath the ground. This is really the cave of the Machpelah. The real cave of the Machpelah is not what you see. The real cave of the Machpelah is completely underground. It's three stories underground. This is actually going down three stories here. I'll show you the entrance in a moment. And this, or this way possibly coming down. And so that you find that there were two, there were one behind the other. And this is just the second part of this picture. Is this is a bird's eye view. Today you probably would call it a drone's eye view. This is what the two caves look down below. This is what you're looking down here is where once again Yitzchak's cave is going to be. There's an entrance that's over here. This is the entrance here. And then there's an entrance over here on this side. The first reference to this really is from this monk in 1119, and we know nothing about it. What happens afterwards is after they go down there, after a while, when the Muslims reconquer it on the Saladin, they actually close things up. Whatever entrances may have been there and whatever openings may have been there are completely closed up on Saladin. And so that no one is able to go into it to find out what there is. Okay, we have about 5 minutes left. So there's actually a story, which I'm not going to have to tell you, which is a story about the Chesed Avram of Avram ben Mordechai Azulai, who dies in 1643. But a story about a sultan who came there and was reaching over into this pit, this opening here, dropping his saber, and was not able to recover his saber, was really upset. Said, lower down soldier after soldier after soldier who came back dead. And finally they said, well, lower down a Jew. And no Jew wanted to go down because it looked like it wouldn't work. The Chesed Avram, Avin Avram Azulai, the father of the Chidah, later to be the Chidah, his father, he said, he was the head of the community in Hebron, says, I'll go down. He is lowered down, and according to the story, he comes down to the bottom of this pit, and he meets three bearded individuals, obviously, and they say, we're Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, and he says, that's great, I'm going to stay down here, I'm not going back there. And he said, you've got to go back up. That's the good news and the bad news. The good news is you'll be coming back down here in 7 days. We'll see you in a week's time. So he brings back the saber, the Jewish community is saved, and of course, a week later, he passes away. That's all, once again, these are all these kinds of stories and tales that are told about it. But what we do know is that there obviously is some kind of room that is underneath it. There's some kind of room underneath where you normally stand. Let me show you what that actually entrance day looks like, and I'm going to tell you the two most important stories about getting into that and then discovering what this is. If you're going today into the Maris Machpelah, and you're actually going to go around from place to place in the Isaac Hall, you're going to see this is entrance. This is the entrance that Sultan was standing over. It's been obviously sealed over and closed down much tighter. And in fact, the entrance here, this is a grate that's on top of it, so nobody's throwing any swords down here. You might be able to throw coins into the holes of this thing. This is the same picture, by the way. They put a little top on top of it because it's important for Islam. And this entrance or this hole itself is about 28 centimeters across, about 12 inches across, about a foot across. Now, no one was ever allowed to go under there. That's why it was sealed shut. Okay, what happened is in 1967, the Israelis take it over, and Moshe Dayan was somewhat of an amateur archaeologist, was trying to look for a way to kind of resolve the issue of the standoff between the Jews and between the Arabs, who gets access to it. And Dayan had heard there was something underneath this whole thing, some kind of passageway, maybe where the caves of Machpelah really were. And as a result, he wanted to go down and see what exactly it was. So there was actually, he had an opportunity, I believe in 67 or 68, when some Arab threw in a grenade and many Jews were wounded and they closed down the whole area. They put the place under lockdown. And he was actually able to get the daughter of the head of the Shin Bet by the name of Michal Arbel. She was a 12-year-old. She was extremely small and skinny. And she was able to be lowered down into this right here, into this entrance, this into a room right below it. And here's, by the way, the picture of Michal Arbel. Arbel, her father, was once again the head of the Shin Bet in Yerushalayim in the West Bank. This was all done under secrecy. She's being lowered down. They gave her matches to make sure the air was breathable. They gave her some type of camera to take pictures. She comes down to the bottom of the actual thing, and she actually finds there's this large room. I'll show you that once again. The room that she sees is this room right here. She comes down. Let's go show you the picture under here. This is the room she comes down. She sees on the bottom that there's money and there's candles, people, the things that were thrown down. And then she wanders down this long hall until she finally finds the stairs at the other end. She goes up the stairs and comes to a dead end, and she can't go any further. It's blocked, and she turns around and comes back. What she does not find the entrance way over here. But here's the picture, some of the pictures that comes from her entrance in 1967. Here we go. These are pictures she took. There she's going down. This is what she sees. She sees this long, narrow chamber. This is the long, narrow chamber going up those stairs. There's, I think, 15 or 16 or 17 stairs. This looks like she's turning around and coming back down. It's a tremendously brave young girl to go down there all by herself. And she really think, if you think about it, what is 28 centimeters across? Who else could go down? And that's all that they really knew from that point of view from 1967, 68, for about the next 15, 16 years. Now, what happens is, over the course of time, everybody really wants to know what's there. They began to figure out, if they calculated the length of the hall that she went, where would it end off? And they began to realize, once again, here it goes, so take it back to this picture here, that if she was put down here and she wandered across, they would, then she had the stairway would have been coming up somewhere over here. This is the end of the Yitzhak chamber. And in 1981, when they did have access to it, but to Davin, it was the month before Rosh Hashanah for Slichos, sometime in October, I think it was October 1981, They had slichas beginning at midnight, like we have slichas the first night. They decided they would extend their slichos. They found that the guards were actually sleepy and were not really paying attention. And instead, what they found is they went through, they began digging and digging. There was a prayer mats on this, in this area here. They pulled the prayer mats back and they found that there was a stones that were cemented in and had these iron bars. And they worked hard and worked hard and chiseled out, and they found they were able to find an entrance way into here. This, by the way, this is the picture of, you see, 1908. This is where the prayer mats were in this entrance here. This is the Jews who are going down in 1981, unbeknownst to the Muslims. They come down to that same hall. Just going to take you back to this map so we can have a better understanding. They come down, they wander down this hall, and once again, they come to the far end. They know where this end is. This is, of course, the room where those candles were thrown and the money was thrown. And they can't figure out, they're feeling a draft here. And suddenly they realize that there's some stones over here, that the stones were a little bit out of whack. And they kind of work at them, and they work at them even more and more until finally they realize that's where the breeze is coming from. They break through the stones, they pull the stones back, and they're actually able to find that there is a cave underneath itself, and the cave is covered. They pull the cover back, and they actually see what the actual Maris Machpelah probably actually is. These are the pictures just so we get a sense of what this is. Yeah, they've come down, they've gone into that first hall, they've wandered all down, and finally they reach a dead end, and they pull back the stones, and they see a small entrance into the cave of Machpelah. Here's the first cave, I believe. There's the first cave behind it. This is the second cave. I think this is the second cave itself. In the second cave, they do find some bones. These may be the bones that the monk Arnal mentioned in the 1100s. And they also find that there is a number of pieces of pottery which they are able to date back to the first temple days, for about the third or fourth century before the Common Era. which it looks like that this may have been, or these caves may have been actually outside the caves, is where the Jews came in the pilgrimage to kind of, you know, some kind of like Kever Avot. I know we're out of time, let me just finish it very quickly. So this is actually what they found. They found that they're able to come down. This is probably the Maris Machpelah, the two caves that there are. Subsequent to them, after they left, the Muslims, of course, you know, were pretty upset when they found out that they had broken down. They engaged a person called Rav Zev Yavin, who is the head of the Israel Antiquities Authority, a very secret mission, and made him swear to secrecy. Later, he was able to reveal it. They sent him down as well, the same way, in order to make sure that things were not damaged. He was able to actually confirm pretty much that the same idea that there are these double caves that were there. He was able to take more examples of the pottery, which they actually subjected to it. This is Dr. Zev Yavin in 1981. And they realized the pottery goes back to the first temple they were, which means that this is long before this building was built on top. This was actually ground level. Ground level was probably coming in here or probably coming in here. And this is probably where the caves themselves are. So when you go to the Maris Machpelah, this is what you're not going to see. You're going to see the part that's above the ground. You're not going to see the part that's below the ground. So let's answer the question very quickly, just in 40 seconds, because we are over time. So who is buried in the Maris Machpelah? And what is there? Because these caves, besides the bones that are lying around on the side of the second cave, there are no really bones of the patriarchs that we found. So there's a couple of possibilities. First of all, there might be other caves. We don't know. Second of all, we understand that it looks like there may be other entrances further in that have been ground filled in. So there may be further entrances here. Maybe the bones of the patriarchs are buried down there. Maybe there were grave robbers who actually stole the bones. That sounds sacrilegious, but it's not necessarily out of the ballpark. But this could have been the place where the patriarchs were buried and the bones may have been taken away. Or maybe there are additional hidden caves that we haven't found. Some of the stories that we find in the Middle Ages don't dovetail exactly with what we can find here today. So the bottom line is, when you go to the Maris Machpelah, and this is actually important to recognize, you're not going to be able to get down there. This you saw, there is a grating that you see when you come into the Yitzchak Hall. The far end, you're never going to get to see it. I believe this is out of bounds today for Jews. Only Muslims can be in that part of the structure complex today. But to recognize that three stories below the ground is this corridor, and four stories below the ground, you're going to find there is this double cave, which once again, as I told you, and here you see it superimposed. This is the drone view, the bird's view. You have the double cave, the first cave, which is larger, going into a second cave. There may be other caves as well, or certain kind of parts of it, which have not been explored, which are not even able to be explored today. Now, how do I know all this? Where do we know all this from? How do I become such a big Talmud Chacham? The answer is, there's a person by the name of Dr. Noam Arnon. Noam Arnon actually published a dissertation. I hadn't seen it myself, but it was written about it. A 600-page dissertation, which he explored for 8 years prior to all of these kind of things. He was one of those, I think, in 1981 who went down here. He did the research. He was able to find the document. And he's actually, I don't know where the dissertation can be found. I think it was Hebrew U. But once again, you will find it pretty much written out there in terms of pretty much what we've told you. So yes, there is a Maris Machpelah. There is a double cave. Where's it going to be? You're not going to be able to find it, but it's really four stories or three or four stories underground. And that's pretty much who is buried in Maris Machpelah. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Rabbi Yeris.
Okay. Wow. Rabbi Grauer.
Grauer has control. Don't worry, everybody. You
do need to have control. You're in control, Rabbi. You're on. Good.
Okay, good. Is my sound is okay, hopefully?
Great. You're good. I'm just going to fade off into the sunset.
Beautiful. Thank you, Rabbi Yaris. What a beautiful, wonderful shiur. Absolutely fascinating. We've all been to, or many of us probably have been to Maris Machpelah. So the ability to learn so many details is certainly quite interesting. Okay, we're going to switch from one cemetery to another cemetery. The original order was actually not structured this way. Initially, Rabbi Idan Rakovsky was supposed to be at this 2 o'clock slot. I was supposed to be at the 3:30 slot. Rabbi Idan had a personal issue that he had to attend to. So as a result, he asked me to switch with him. So if you're looking for Rabbi Idan, he'll be here at 3:30 a bit later on. Let me begin by thanking Rabbi Mordechai Torchiner, our Rosh Kolol, for this incredible program and this just wonderful initiative of learning on this Sunday. Let me thank as well Serena and David Kashitsky, who are dedicating this entire program in memory of their sister-in-law, Riva, an exceptional woman, amazing family on both sides who I know. I didn't have the opportunity to know Riva personally, But if her children are any indication, then she certainly must have been someone special. I also, of course, want to mention the individual sponsors for this next half hour or 25-minute segment. Number one, dedicated by Ellen Warner and Jeff.